Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, November 2nd, 2012, and yay, it's my birthday. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am actually all alone here today on my birthday. My co-host Alyssa is not able to make it today. Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary that you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage the movement toward a world in which animals are treated with compassion and mercy and are afforded the same rights that humans take for granted. This program can be heard every Friday from noon till 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at coopradio.org and available as podcasts on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. We have two feature interviews for you today, which are actually rebroadcasts of interviews that we did last year and earlier this year. First in the show, we have a fantastic interview with Leah Lemieux, who is an advocate for cetaceans, that is, dolphins and whales, and has been for much of her life. Last year, I read her beautiful narrative of a book entitled Rekindling the Waters, The Truth About Swimming with Dolphins, in which Leah uses such sophisticated and colorful language to paint her readers an enrapturing story of her experiences over the last few decades of developing unique personal relationships with captive dolphins, as well as with interacting with those in the wild. Through her years of experience in dedicating her life to these magnificent and fascinating creatures, Leah has come to learn more about the issues surrounding the captive dolphin industry at what I would call an expert level, and has certainly over this time developed a very strong convictions on the ethics and logistics of these practices. I am so pleased to be able to have Leah on the show again to speak with us about her experiences with dolphins and her knowledge on the captive dolphin industry, which is, of course, the industry that routinely hunts and captures dolphins in the wild to sell them to marine parks around the world for entertainment and huge monetary profits. And if you're a regular listener to the show, you'll know that at the beginning of this season's annual dolphin hunt and slaughter in Taiji, Japan, started this September the 1st and plans to continue until next March. So it's an issue that should definitely be in the forefront of your minds when it comes to the animals. And for our second interview today, we have author and animal activist Nick Cooney on the show with us. Nick is the founder of the U.S. nonprofit organization for the animals called the Humane League, and currently works as the compassionate communities manager of Farm Sanctuary. He is also the author of a fantastic and very educational book that I've been reading lately called Change of Heart, What Psychology Can Teach Us About Spreading Social Change. And he will be with us here today to talk to us exactly on this topic as discussed in his book, which will include some of the many different factors and tactics to know about and to use when it comes to understanding the complexities of how the human mind works with regards to making positive changes for the animals. Nick has delved into this subject thoroughly and provides many examples in his book that explores and verifies the way that people think regarding social issues, particularly those pertaining to the animals. This is another excellent interview that I think you'll enjoy, so please do stay tuned for that. I just wanted to make a quick mention of a listener call that we had last week in regards to our interview with Camille Labchuk, who made a plea to the Ontario Human Rights Commission earlier this year to have veganism, ethical veganism, considered as a human right. We had a caller from a listener after the show. I think his name was George, and if you're listening, we'll call you George. The phone number that you gave us to call you back didn't work. So I just wanted to say that I was in touch with Camille, and the advice that she gave was, I should say what your issue is you're living in a care home and they're not giving you vegan food. So it would indeed be a factor whether it's a public facility or a private one. If it is a public facility, the Charter of Freedom of Conscience right comes into play, and you're definitely protected under that. If you're in a public home, this is something that you should explain to them. If you're in a private facility, I think that, you know, if you or your family are paying them to feed you and take care of you, they really need to provide you meals of your choosing. And I really feel it's important to have an advocate for you to speak up for you, because sometimes it's hard, difficult for the patients to actually be taken seriously in some of these facilities. I know that from personal experience. If this doesn't work, Camille also suggests a place like the BC Center for Elderly Advocacy Support. Their website address is bccas.ca. So thank you for that phone call. And right now we've got the interview with Leah. Forgive me for taking a little while to load this up. I am doing this all by myself today, so I just have to find out where this is here, and I shall play it for you. So today's feature interview is with whale and dolphin advocate Leah Lemieux. She is an author and lecturer who has been working on dolphin protection, education, and conservation initiatives for 20 years, collaborating with individuals and NGOs from a number of countries, including the Jane Goodall Institute's Roots and Shoots Environmental and Humanitarian Program. In 2009, she published a book of her years of personal experiences with dolphins entitled Rekindling the Waters, The Truth About Swimming with Dolphins, which exposes the harsh realities of the lives that dolphins in captivity face, always to their detriment and often to their demise. Leah is here with us today to speak to us about what her experiences have taught her about dolphins and the captive dolphin industry. Hello, Leah, and welcome to the Animal Voices radio show.
Hi, thanks for having me on. This is great.
I want to start by asking you to tell us in brief your story of how you came to live a life that involved having the honor to create personal relationships with dolphins and to thus have them become an integral part of your life. How did this all happen?
Well, I have always had a love and a fascination with them as long as I can remember, but really it all started, I was fairly young, about 16 or 17, and I found myself in Cuba on a vacation and was just fortunate enough to connect with some of the trainers that worked at a captive dolphin lagoon. And around the same time, back in Toronto, where I lived, I also became aware that there was a dolphin conservation group operating in the city there. So I went out shortly after meeting these captive dolphins to a film event, and it showed underwater footage of the horrific dolphin slaughters happening on tuna boats, which probably everyone's aware of now, but at the time it was just making waves. And the director of this little group also had behind-the-scenes footage of the local marine land, which was just horrific. The conditions that the whales and dolphins were being kept where no one could see them, and it was this tremendous moment of having my eyes opened, where it was the first time I was ever aware anybody anywhere was harming dolphins in any way, and it was a real eye-opener about the captivity industry because the conditions were so stark. So that was, those two things happened at the same time, and one thing led to another. I volunteered with the group. I eventually became assistant director and represented them at expos and conferences all over the place. And meanwhile, I had found this sort of serendipitous in to the international trade of dolphins in the Caribbean, which was centered in Cuba. So all these things happened at once. By fate or design, I don't know.
I was just going to say that it was meant to be, I think. I can't imagine your life not being about dolphins from reading your book. You know, that is who you are, it seems like.
Yeah, I love what I do. I love this, and my whole life is dedicated to this in one form or another, yeah.
So can you talk to us about what you've learned about the interpersonal lives of both captive and wild dolphins? For example, what are their social structures like? I know they are highly social creatures, like many animal species are. Can you speak about that a bit?
Well, the first thing to bring up is their social situation is very different in captivity in artificial circumstances than it is in the ocean. So those are two very different things of what you will see happening in a captive environment versus in the ocean. They are very social creatures. They're very political creatures. they are meant to operate within their natural societies when that's taken away from them by us mixing and matching them, putting them in captivity. And of course, we have to remember, even the largest tanks at the best facilities represent less than 1% of a dolphin's natural territory. So when you put them in those circumstances, the social things that happen are very, they tend to involve a lot of fighting and pecking order that doesn't show in the same way in the wild. In the wild, they have the opportunity to disperse and get away from interactions they don't want to be a part of, or they have the option of having the help of friends and family if there's a disagreement in dolphin society. So they're really, you'll see really, really different things in captivity versus the wild.
And you definitely have yourself. I know you write in your book about how the group of dolphins that you were friends with, they would have fights with each other, and these are over dominance issues, as you've spoken about. And you're right, their space that they shared was a small space, and they couldn't get away from that. So that really does make sense when you're talking about the differences there between the wild dolphins, who have the whole ocean right between them to settle their differences. Mm-hmm. You know, they can swim away, but these dolphins can't exactly do that, and they're forced to deal with these social issues that they wouldn't be able to in the wild. What about the emotions of dolphins? Through your detailed recountals in your book, you've described much about the personalities of these creatures, and with that, the emotions that go with them. You've illustrated that wild dolphins, the dolphins you've been with, are often jovial, playful, humorous, and loving. They can also be crafty, angry, stubborn, and jealous, just as we humans are. I guess these adjectives I'm giving are how we identify these manners as being, but from the multiple stories of the dolphins' behaviors in your book, I have to say, as I'm sure you do too, that these really are the emotions that they are displaying. I don't think this is anthropomorphizing it. And can you talk about dolphin emotions and what you have learned in your experiences regarding this?
Sure, yeah. One of the things I did spend over a decade with this particular group of dolphins, and you learned you weren't anthropomorphizing, because over time you'd realize these emotions that you were pretty sure represented what they were experiencing, right, did play out in the behavior. So there was physical proof that what you were guessing was going on, once I got to know the individuals and the situation, it would play out. There would be physical evidence that the gist I was getting was very much along the same lines. Now, one of the things we have to remember is we, like dolphins and like elephants and like chimpanzees, all share the same type of intelligence, which is social intelligence, meaning it appears that we all developed our great big brains in order to deal with each other in society. Now, with humans, we've also got the application of tool use with our hands. Elephants may have something similar with their trunks, perhaps, and dolphins, obviously, their apparatus is all internal with their sounds that they use, and they can manipulate things with that. But it's this social intelligence, this political intelligence, that we all share and seems to be the driving force behind why we got our big brains. So there is, strangely enough, despite 50 million years of separate evolution here, we do share common ground, and it's in the social and political milieu. So that really helps us relate as two different species, is on this emotional and social plane. Looking at the dolphin's brain, the limbic system there is very highly developed, and in fact, Dr. Thomas White, in his book In Defense of Dolphins, who really, really goes into this, the architecture of the dolphin brain and what that means, he has actually postulated that just by looking at their brains, they may actually be more emotional than we are. And that's actually hard to believe, because we're such emotional creatures. But
is it hard for you to believe?
That may, in fact, be the case. Mm-hmm. That in that realm, they are actually more sophisticated and have a greater capacity to experience things. And I'm sure that includes things that we don't understand as land-based mammals, but there's lots that we can understand.
So
and it does reflect in their very sophisticated social behavior.
I'd like to talk a bit more about dolphin intelligence. So dolphins are often regarded to be the second most intelligent non-human animals in the world after the apes. Whenever you see a list of, you know, the most intelligent animals in the world, from 1 to 10, they're always number 2. This is in a sense of how we humans measure intelligence, obviously. Although I do like how you say in your book that due to the way we are poisoning and destroying the earth, we humans are a poor example of a highly intelligent life form. Very true. And the dolphins are certainly not going to be ruining the planet. But with regards to dolphins, can you tell us your thoughts on what quantifies as them being highly intelligent creatures? What have you learned about this in your experiences with them?
Well, the science that looks at intelligence will tell us it will include things like flexible learning behavior, novel problem solving, an ability to understand language, syntax, long memories, the ability to mimic, mirror, self-recognition. All of those things are definitely true about the dolphin. An interesting thing I sort of learned was it's our own intelligence and awareness that allows us to recognize it in others, whether those others are another human being or perhaps something shaped like a dolphin. So I find people that are really intelligent and aware themselves and don't have any particular cultural biases that they have to get through tend to be able to look a dolphin or a whale in the eyes and really get a sense that there's somebody looking back at them and thinking thoughts. And that absolutely encapsulates what my experiences were. They are now being qualified by some scientists as non-human persons, because when we go down the list of things that make a person, not a Homo sapiens, which is biological, but a person philosophically, dolphins are checking all the checks down the list. So that's what I found about their intelligence. It is like interacting with people that are from a profoundly different element and culture.
So getting to the core of the matter, which is that these beautiful creatures are being hugely exploited by humankind, can you talk to us about the dolphin capture industry and tell our listeners, perhaps those who have in the past paid to watch captive dolphin shows or to swim with them or who are considering doing so, what do they need to know about this industry?
Well, the first thing to realize is there's no argument that these aren't amazing creatures to get close to. So you can absolutely understand why we'd want to get close to them any way that was presented to us. I think what people really need to know is that because of the capture process and the effects of imprisonment on these incredible far-roaming and sophisticated creatures, that there's always tremendous harm involved. So if people love and appreciate these creatures, they really have to think twice about contributing to something that is ultimately harmful.
And one of the quotes from your book is painting a picture of the environment that they live in, ridiculous tricks, bubbly, charismatic trainers, and blaring music used to distract audiences from contemplating the stark, barren enclosures. Unimaginable boredom, cramped, stressful spaces, chlorinated synthetic salt water, noisy crowds, nutritionally inferior, dead, frozen fish, and in the worst cases, lack of fresh air and sunlight all contribute to the impoverished lives and lifespans of captive cetaceans. I thought that was really powerful.
Yeah, you've seen that, Leah.
Yeah.
Listed in a nutshell, these things are true across the board. You know, if there's dolphins in a large outdoor lagoon, it's not going to be as bad as a small indoor concrete enclosure, but really it's just about lesser evils. These things are true across the board, and we are unable to provide appropriate circumstances for such an incredibly far-roaming, socially sophisticated and intelligent and sensitive creature. We can't do it.
And
despite what the aquariums are telling us, it's impossible. We can't create appropriate circumstances in captivity for them.
I'd like to point out, too, that it's all about the bottom line, as you say in the book. It's all about money. So many marine parks, which all label themselves by law as being conservation education facilities, and I didn't know that actually before reading your book, that they are required to call themselves that. So they toot that their facilities allow people to feed, touch, and see real dolphins right up close, which people otherwise would not have the opportunity to do so. And in fact, this is an argument that I heard firsthand last year in support of keeping whales and dolphins in captivity at the Vancouver Aquarium when that was up for discussion. When people use this argument as their most viable one for continuing these dolphin educational programs at these facilities, what is your response to that?
My response is that these have become simply buzzwords, positive buzzwords that elicit the response that they're meant to from the public. Of course, everybody wants to support educational and conservation-based initiatives. Of course, those are positive things. Of course, in this case, we're just looking at positive words being used to spin something that is, as I said, harmful. We have to remember that aquariums and dolphinariums are first and foremost businesses. They have to run as businesses. They're there to make money. That is their bottom line, always. So buzzwords are used to paint things green when they're not necessarily that way.
So how is it that people are so easily convinced by these dolphinarium entertainment facilities that what they are doing is just in good fun and of no harm? What do you think is the psychology behind that, believing the happy scenarios that these places make the efforts to portray? And this actually ties into the theme of what we were speaking about earlier about the farm animals at the P&E. How is it? You say that most people don't have a clue of what's going on. How does that happen?
Well, one of the things we have to remember is all of these places have enormous budgets for PR and advertising, and everything is painted in a Disney-like way as being all is happy and good at the aquarium. So we have to remember there's a budget there, and what they're playing on is our natural affinity for these amazing creatures. So that part's natural, and they're just cashing in on that. We want to believe that these circumstances are not harmful so that we can connect. We're used to having nature caged at our feet, basically, as a convenience, as opposed to making the effort to get out to sea into their environment, which isn't always, it's sometimes hostile to us, the weather can be bad, etc. Unfortunately, these facilities encourage public ignorance. They cash in on our ignorance.
They wouldn't make money if people weren't ignorant.
Of course not. So the love affair between humans and dolphins and whales is often one-sided in captivity, but that is generally glossed over, unfortunately.
You say that when people pause for a moment of reflection and take a critical look around, then the terrible, indisputable truth is plainly revealed. Do you think that is starting to happen now, just with the, just with films like The Cove coming out and your book, I hope, that perhaps people will just become more aware of these situations, or I hope is happening? I mean, there's a lot happening in the news right now about what's happening in Taiji, for example. In your mind, is there a tipping point approaching where people will start?
Absolutely, there is. The Cove, in and of itself, is, after 90 minutes of watching that, 99% of the people who watch it get it. It's an incredible piece. It absolutely deserves all the awards that have been heaped on it. It's created a revolution, really, across the planet, because it's so much is put into that film, and it's so very watchable and digestible. It really helps people get it. It's not that hard to get. In some ways, it's just putting the shoe on the other foot. Would you like to be abducted off the street and stuck in jail and have somebody else decide, do you get air, do you get light, do you get food, when are you going to dance for your supper, are they going to take your children from you? It's not that hard to put ourselves in the shoes of
it's
a whale.
It's not that hard, but it's not just whales. It's so many animals, right, that are being exploited. But, oh, my gosh. I just want to let our listeners know you are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And Alyssa has a question now.
Yeah, so, okay. So Allison had mentioned that the Vancouver Aquarium is part of the captive cetacean industry, and I guess we have Marineland in Ontario, and we used to have dolphins in the West Edmonton Mall. I wonder if you could shed some light on exactly how the captive dolphin industry is tied to Canada. The exploitation of these creatures is certainly happening here, and I'd like to know a bit more about that.
Yes, my book goes into quite a lot of detail about how Marineland over near Toronto has been tied into the captive dolphin trade coming out of the Caribbean. So that is one area. Just the area that I was in, the whole resident population of wild bottlenose dolphins was wiped out by captures for the captivity industry, and a lot of those went to Marineland, and they have a terrible track record there, so they were just dying in droves, and they'd go out and get more. So that was happening right there. Now, if we're going to look at the Vancouver Aquarium, something really disturbing that's been found recently is that the three Pacific white-sided dolphins that are there now at the aquarium have come from Japan. And the claim is made that these dolphins were rescued. And again, we're seeing a euphemistic buzzword being used. But the fact of the matter is the Japanese do not rescue dolphins. The men who capture dolphins for captivity are the same men who hunt them and kill them. And these dolphins were caught from the wild, the ones that are at the Vancouver Aquarium right now. They were brought to a Japanese aquarium, and then they were brought to Canada. And the reason for that is, as far as permits go, it's much easier to get the permit to move the animals into Canada when it's through another facility as opposed to straight from the ocean. So that's what's going on there. So what that means is that our Vancouver Aquarium is wheeling and dealing with the very same people who capture and kill dolphins in Japan. And I'm pretty sure most of the people going there would be horrified to learn that. Mm-hmm. But that's what following the blood trail, basically, leads us to, is to realize this. And it's very... Mm-hmm. very troubling.
Well, as an educational facility, certainly they're telling all of their the people that support them about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was being facetious there.
When somebody actually sees the cove and sees what's going on there and then realizes that this is basically where the dolphins are coming from, that's not to say they're coming from Taiji, the exact cove that's being shown in the film. That's not known for sure, but similar practices, drives, and kills of dolphins that include the capture of the few who are sold to aquariums all over the world, and three of them have ended up right in the middle of Vancouver. That is definitely troubling.
So for those of us who are already informed on the issues and already know that we want to do something to help the situation, what solutions can you offer to our listeners on how to end the dolphin captive industry? What do we need to do to become part of the solution?
You know what? There's one simple thing that everyone can start with, and it's so simple. Don't buy a ticket to any facilities that have captive dolphins and whales. That's the most and first and most important thing that everybody can do. Beyond that, you can visit SaveJapanDolphins.org or RekindlingTheWaters.com, and both of those in their fact sections have a whole bunch of suggestions for people to get involved and do things in their own community to help out.
Thank you so much, Leah, for coming on the show to talk to us about dolphins and the issues surrounding dolphin captivity.
Drishti Point is a radio program featuring interviews about yoga, spirituality, and wellness. Our guests include yogis, authors, musicians, healers, and renowned spiritual teachers. Tune in Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. for your weekly dose of yoga wisdom and inspiration.
over the past 2 weeks of shows, we have promoted an event with an aim to raise funds for a particular human health charity. It's come to our attention that the particular charity does, in fact, use animal testing. Animal Voices apologizes for this oversight, and we'd like the opportunity to promote the Humane Charity Seal of Approval. It helps donors identify charities that are committed to providing vital services and care to patients or advancing research without the use of animals. Their motto is Give and Let Live. For a list of approved charities, check out the website humaneseal.org. Next, I want to promote a group on meetup.com. They're called Veg Meetup. They're a veg socializing group. They're actually the oldest and original veg group on meetup.com in Vancouver. There's a great chance for vegan and vegetarian adults to socialize with other veg mates, make friends, and have fun. So it's really open to anyone who's interested in the veg lifestyle or who's trying to go veg. Everyone's welcome. And I wanted to promote their vegan Chinese dinner. It's Saturday, November 24th at 6 p.m. It's at Whole Vegetarian Restaurant, but not the one that we know of on Main Street. But actually, this is a new location at 1018 Beach Avenue in Vancouver, basically under the downtown side of the Burrard Bridge. Most have visited the Whole Vegetarian on Main Street, and I think they'll have a similar menu. The highlights of the set menu that night include bean curd skin rolls with black bean sauce, Shanghai-style pan-fried vegetables, chili tofu with sesame sauce, mushroom balls, spicy green beans, and chili eggplant with chou hao sauce. Sounds very tasty, and all this plus a whole bunch more dishes are just $18 per person. It includes HST, tip, and chip-in for the meetup website fee. It's cash only, and you're supposed to bring exact change. And tomorrow afternoon, that's Saturday, November 3rd, from 2 till 4, the Fur Bear Defenders invite you to assemble with them in a silent vigil for victims of the fur trade. It's a tribute to non-human animals who've lost their lives at the hands of the fur trade, either as targeted animals or as quote-unquote trash animals, such as birds, endangered species, or even dogs and cats. This vigil will be at the Downtown Art Gallery on the Robson Street side between Howe and Hornby, and a simultaneous vigil will occur in downtown Toronto. Fur Bear Defenders will ask that everyone hold signs that share the disturbing truths that the industry works so hard to distort. They'll also ask that people wear red scarves while holding deactivated traps and photographs of animals commonly killed in the traps. And the scarves and the traps, of course, will be provided. All signage and messaging and literature will be provided. So activists are asked not to bring anything. Try to dress in dark colors and dress warmly, as the nature of the vigil is to stand still for the duration. Activists are encouraged to stay for the duration, but anyone can come and show support. That's welcomed. For more information, you can contact Leslie Fox at leslie@furbearerdefenders.com. Also coming up is the Liberation BC November Volunteer Night. That's Tuesday, November 13th, 6 until 9. That's at the ING Cafe at 466 Howe and Pender Street downtown. In preparation for leafleting Paul McCartney's upcoming concert on November 25th, we're going to be making signs and banners to remind approximately 52,000 guests of Paul's love of animals and his commitment to animal rights. He is quoted as saying, "If slaughterhouses had glass walls, everyone would be a vegetarian." As usual, Liberation BC's monthly volunteer night will provide yummy vegan snacks and lots of fun, and they welcome you to drop by at any time. And then later, the leafleting event and outreach event will be Sunday, November 25th, and that's Paul McCartney's concert downtown. So put that on your calendar. And finally, on Saturday, November 24th, 11 to 1, there's going to be a protest about the dolphin slaughter in Taiji, Japan, as exposed in the award-winning documentary The Cove. This is a worldwide event, and the message is positive. Japan, let the dolphins live and be free. The event will start at the Vancouver Art Gallery downtown at 750 Hornby Street at 11 a.m. They plan to take a leisurely stroll past the Embassy Building at 1075 West Pender Street, and they're going to gather outside to protest peacefully. Let's make our voices be heard and encourage all media to report on what's happening to the dolphins in Taiji. For more information about what's happening there and how you can help dolphins, visit SaveJapanDolphins.org.
And now here we have an interview that was done with Nick Cooney earlier this year in May. You are listening to the Animal Voices Vancouver radio show here on 100.5 FM CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Your interview is with author and activist Nick Cooney. Nick is the founder of the animal advocacy organization, the Humane League, and currently works as the Compassionate Communities Manager at the nonprofit organization Farm Sanctuary. His advocacy work has been featured in hundreds of media outlets, including Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and National Public Radio. Nick holds a degree in nonviolent studies from Hofstra University and formerly worked conducting nutrition education programs with the University of Pennsylvania's Urban Nutrition Initiative. He is also the author of a recent book called Change of Heart, What Psychology Can Teach Us About Spreading Social Change. And he is here today to speak with us about some of the many points of interest as discussed and explored in this book to help us understand more about how the human mind works so that we may be empowered to use this knowledge to help the animals. Hello, Nick, and welcome to the Animal Voices radio show.
Hi, happy to be here.
So as I just briefly mentioned, your book, Change of Heart, explores the complexities of how the minds of us human beings work with regards to many facets of societal issues that affect how we as human beings regard and treat those around us, be they people or animals. But the book definitely has a slant towards animal issues, and I feel it is directed at the activists among us who want to learn more about how humans think so that we can be effective in spreading the social change among our communities. Is that why you decided to write this book as a tool for activists that isn't commonly explored? In your own terms, what is the book about, and how did you come about writing Change of Heart?
Right, yeah, as you imagined, I've been doing animal advocacy work for about 13 years now, and I've been interested in human psychology for quite a while as well, just interested in why people make the decisions that they make and why they have the behaviors that they have. So the book was kind of putting those two things together. In other words, when I was doing animal advocacy day to day, I would always wonder how could I be more effective at getting through to people and persuading them to change their attitudes and change their behaviors to be more kind to animals. And so throughout the book, I went to the academic research. I looked at all the research in fields like psychology, sociology, and related fields, communication, to see what techniques have been proven to be more effective at getting people to make these behavior changes that we as animal advocates really want the public to make.
I'm intrigued by the many psychological definitions and tactics that you write about in the book, and you give numerous examples of how they have been proven in the past in scientific studies as well as in real-life cases. I'd like to start by exploring some of these designations with you. For example, let's define a few primary terms and explain how they pertain to animal rights issues. Can you talk about what a bias of concern is, as well as explain the availability of bias?
Sure. So bias of concern is something that all of us as human beings have. And when it comes to social issues, it means that people in general, including us animal advocates, we're inclined to care more about issues that either affect us directly or affect those that are similar to us or those we're close to. How that might manifest itself in the animal protection field, the most pertinent example would be the fact that the animals that the public, as well as most people who consider themselves animal advocates, care about would be companion animals, cats and dogs, primarily maybe rabbits and horses. And the reason that is because a lot of Americans have those animals in their homes, they have direct experience with those animals, and therefore they care more about a cat or a dog than, say, a chicken or a pig, even though the chicken or pig may be enduring a lot more suffering. So that's what the bias of concern is and how it operates. The availability bias is somewhat similar. It's basically that we as people in general, and also we as advocates, we tend to be more concerned with social issues that we're hearing a lot about. So whether our friends are talking about them, whether we're reading about it in the newspaper or seeing it on TV, the more we've heard about it, the more important we tend to think that issue is. And the problem with both of these biases for us as activists is that it can lead us to put our time and attention and energy into causes that, yes, might be very popular right now, they might be in the media, and yes, they may concern animals that we personally have a great affiliation for, like the dogs and cats we have in our homes. But they're not necessarily going to be the issues where we could do the most good for animals. And the same certainly applies to the public in general. Whether you're a donor to nonprofit organizations or a volunteer, we have those biases, so it's important to try to examine those. And instead of just putting our time and energy towards those causes that are familiar to us or that we hear about a lot about in the media, we really need to put our time and energy and donation dollars into those causes where instead we can get the most good done for animals.
There are other psychological barriers when it comes to people making more compassionate decisions, many psychological barriers, and one of these is empathy avoidance, which you talk about in the book. As animal advocates, we try to educate people on the many serious issues facing animal welfare these days, and it is often met by resistance and apathy. Why is this? Why do people want to avoid feeling empathy in these situations, which in turn could cause them to change their actions?
Yeah, empathy avoidance is something that every one of us, myself included, feel on a pretty regular basis. And it is that if we hear about something negative going on in the world, or if someone is asking us for a donation or help, or someone's encouraging us to change our behavior in some way, whether that's go vegan, buy locally raised vegetables, ride the bus instead of driving your car, any of these sort of things, we have it sort of, and most of us have an instinctual reaction to not want to do those things. And the reason is pretty simple. It's that it would inconvenience us, or it might cost more money, or it's going to take time and energy in some fashion. And so whenever we hear about a situation that may be sad or maybe unfortunate, but would require change of us and our behavior, have this instinctual response to not want to care so that we're not motivated to make the change. So those of us who are advocates for animals, we, like every other social cause, have to deal with empathy avoidance. We have to realize that most people, even when they hear about, say, the cruelties of factory farming, they agree that it's wrong. A lot of them are going to still try to not empathize too much with the animals for fear that it might prompt them to go vegetarian, since in their minds, going vegetarian or going vegan would be a lot of work, would be giving up the food they love, and so on and so forth.
You write about in the book how people are largely insensitive to statistics and numbers. So when you simply tell people that billions of farmed animals are suffering every day, for example, that's not going to have as nearly much as an effect on them as, on the other hand, telling them the story of one particular farm animal who has suffered. What are your beliefs on why people think this way, and how should we effectively use these thought processes in our advocacy for the animals?
Well, we human beings, we like to think sometimes that our minds are just perfect logical machines and that every belief we have and every way that we operate just makes complete rational sense. But the reality is very far from that. You know, our brains were shaped by evolution and the forces of evolution. They were not crafted to be perfectly logical machines. And so there's a lot of results to that, and one certainly is that we tend to care much more about individuals than we care about groups. And just to give a few examples of that, the Kony 2012 video, which became viral across North America and was extremely popular, brought a lot of attention to that issue because it told a very personal narrative. The narrator of that story told his own personal experience about how he got involved with this issue and why it matters so much to him. And we see these sort of things all the time. When there's a particularly egregious animal cruelty case, and there's an animal that's badly injured but that survives and is available for adoption, and his or her stories in the media, tons and tons of phone calls and email requests will pour in trying to adopt that specific individual.
I find it interesting. I find it interesting how whenever a cow escapes from the slaughterhouse, everyone's rooting for that cow, and they want the cow saved. However, what do we do to cows on a daily basis?
Sure. Perfect example.
Well, one commonality that I see with people who are unwilling to change their actions for the animals is that some people have a disconnect between their ethical beliefs and their actual behaviors. You identify this in your book as the attitude-behavior gap. Can you expand more, please, on what the attitude-behavior gap is? And as animal advocates, what proactive responses can we make to defeat this hurdle in people's minds? And it would seem that merely campaigning to change attitudes is not enough to actually create change.
You're perfectly correct on that point. People's attitudes, and this has been shown time and time again, on a variety of social issues, including animal protection issues, but others as well, people's attitudes many times just don't match up with their behaviors. If you ask Americans, is it important to buy American-made products, virtually everyone will say yes, but very few of them will actually make the time and effort to do that. Polls that have polled Americans about what they think about animals, you know, animals should be used or not used in our society, have found, for example, a Gallup poll found 25% of Americans say they think that animals should have the same rights as human beings. Mm-hmm. And obviously, they're not living that way because most of that 25% is still eating animals. So unless eating your neighbor is, you know, an ethically justifiable thing to do, clearly there's this big gap between people's attitudes and between their and their behaviors. And so the consequence of that for us is people who may care about animals or want the public to do more animal-friendly things is, as you point out, it's not enough to just get them to change their attitude and get them to agree with where we're coming from. What's important is that we get them to change their behavior, and that requires a little bit of a different focus in our messaging, in our communications, and in how we go about our advocacy.
In your book, you dedicate a large part to describing what tools of influence we may effectively use as activists for social change. And you say that in order to educate and motivate people to do something, our communications need to simplify the issue and call for clear, specific action. Can you please expand more on what you mean by this and how we may effectively motivate change in people by narrowing their options?
Sure. And this is another example of a situation where the human mind works pretty much the opposite of how we think it works. So if I, as an animal advocate, want the public to do something, to do good things for animals, I might think that, okay, I'm going to give a list of, I'm going to give the public a list of 10 things that they can do to help animals. And the more things I give them, the more likely they are to find something on that list they agree with and can have time and interest for, and the more likely they are to do something, one of these 10 things to help animals. But studies have found that, again, counter to our intuition, this is not the case. And in fact, the more choices we give people, the less likely they are to choose anything whatsoever. The reason for this is something that researchers call decision paralysis. Basically, there's too many choices to pick between, and so most people will go with the default option, which is, I'm not going to do any of these. I'm just going to keep doing what I had been doing before. And so if we want to inspire people to action, well, we need to give them a very clear, specific thing to do, not a list to choose from, not a long list of recommendations, some very specific call to action, and again, call to behavioral change.
One thing that I like about your book is that you share with your readers all these neat little psychological techniques that I, as someone with no formal prior background in psychology, know anything about. So it's fascinating and very educational for me to read about these. One of these techniques is called the foot in the door. What is the foot in the door technique, Nick, and how can we use this method effectively for animal activism?
I'm glad you asked that question, because foot in the door is, it's a well-studied, well-documented psychological phenomenon, and it's one that's really important for any of us who are advocates of vegetarian or vegan eating to keep in mind. In a nutshell, what foot in the door is if you want an individual to make a significant change in a behavior, you'll probably be more effective at getting them to make that change in behavior by first making a small, easy request of them, and then once they do that, letting a little time pass, and then making your second, a larger request. So in other words, to put this into practice in terms of promoting vegetarian and vegan eating, chances are that if we're doing general outreach to the public, chances are we'll get more people to ultimately go vegan if we first make a smaller request, like, say, going vegetarian or reducing your meat consumption or going meatless on Mondays. And then once people make that slight change, letting some time pass, and going back and making that second, larger request to them. The foot in the door has been documented in countless studies. There are literally over 1,000 academic studies that have been done on foot in the door, and a meta-analysis of all these studies found that overall, on average, using the foot in the door technique will increase your success by about 10%. It can vary, and in some cases it was dramatically more than that. So this is one of those psychological issues where there's incredibly important takeaway for any of us who want to promote an animal-friendly diet. And that is, if we want the maximum number of people moving towards and eventually adopting a vegan diet, if we want to reduce the number of animals being eaten for food in the United States, then with most audiences, we would do well to start with requesting a smaller change and not a full immediate conversion to veganism.
You say in the book that when people are told that someone is about to try to influence them on a topic that matters to them, they are less likely to be influenced. Why is this, and how does cognitive dissonance come into play in this type of scenario?
Right. This is a situation that I think probably all of us have experienced in our life. I'm sure all of us have dealt with a salesman who is trying to persuade us to buy something, or, you know, a religious individual who is trying to persuade us to their religious point of view. And I think it's just an ingrained aspect of our minds that we want to feel like we are independent people, that we come to the decisions we have and the behaviors and attitudes that we have because we thought about them and because that's who we are. So if someone were to come along and be able to, in a few minutes of talking to us, immediately persuade us to change our attitude, to change our behaviors, what would that say about us? It would say that we're stupid, or we hadn't thought about the issue, or we're just very gullible and easily persuaded. And nobody wants to feel that way about themselves. So we don't want to feel like we're being persuaded by people. At the same time, of course, we're being persuaded all the time. We as Americans are being persuaded to shop at certain stores, eat in certain restaurants, wear our hair and our clothes a certain way, and so on and so forth. So while people are obviously persuaded constantly by others, it's important for us as advocates to not be so transparent about the fact that we're trying to change others' behavior. So this would manifest itself whether we're having a conversation with a friend or family or coworker, or if we're an actual activist or volunteer for animal protection causes. You know, rather than go out and be really explicit that, you know, I want you to go vegan, or I want you to stop buying fur, or, you know, things like that, where we're clearly just trying to change what the person is doing and thinking, we need to be a little calmer, a little more subtle, a little more laid back in that regard if we want to be as effective as possible.
I'd like to talk a bit about Facebook and the power of social network activism, which we were discussing earlier on the show today. You talk about the connectors in your book to describe people who have large numbers of friends and acquaintances. How can we use Facebook and other forms of social networking to successfully influence people to make positive changes for the animals?
It's a very good question. Change often spreads along social lines. So if I decide to go vegetarian and go vegan, then there's an increased chance that my close friends, my family members, and my close coworkers will make the same switch. This hasn't been documented specifically to vegetarian and vegan eating, but it has been extensively documented in terms of other behaviors, including smoking, weight gain or loss, political affiliation, happiness, and a few other traits. So it's pretty safe for us to assume that the same applies for dietary change in terms of vegetarian or veganism as well. And Facebook just amplifies that because it amplifies the rate of communication between individuals. And one way, just to give an example of a way that Facebook has been really used to spread the message of vegetarian and vegan eating, one of the campaigns that a number of organizations are doing is sharing videos of farm animal cruelty and information about vegetarian eating, and making on the web pages that do those things, including very prominent Facebook share buttons, including Facebook comment plugins and things like that, that allow people who are moved by what they see in the video to immediately share it with their friends on Facebook, or to post a comment that is going to be immediately seen by others on Facebook as well. And so that's an example of a way that the movement has used Facebook to not only reach the people who are immediately seeing these videos or these resources, but to have that information immediately transferred and shown to their friends as well. And so their friends are going to be doubly motivated to make a change, both by the power of the video and also by the power of their friend's recommendation of this as being a video worth watching.
I found it interesting in your book how you mentioned how, like, just if any average person decides to go vegetarian, several dozen of that person's friends will find out and then maybe think about doing the same. Because I actually find that's true, that, you know, the people, for my personal experiences, the people around me, those being people who I have influenced, be it directly or indirectly, they're the people that I know who have gone vegetarian. It's an interesting psychological, perhaps unintentional tactic to use. But anyways, I just wanted to put that out there, is that when you talk about connectors and people just influencing and not even realizing that you're influencing, it does happen for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So before we go, I'd like to ask you to briefly talk about the work that you are doing now as the Compassionate Communities Manager at an organization that we love here at Animal Voices, and that's Farm Sanctuary. Please tell us about this.
Sure. Yeah, I'm thrilled to be working with Farm Sanctuary on their Compassionate Communities campaign. I encourage everyone to check it out. It's online at www.compassionatecommunities.org. Basically, what Compassionate Communities is are Farm Sanctuary's way of helping individual animal advocates, which I'm sure is everyone listening to this program, do effective veg advocacy in their own community. So whether you live in a big town or small town, whether you've been doing animal advocacy for years or whether you'd be brand new to it, we'll give you the tools and the materials to get started. We'll give you step-by-step instructions and advice on the most effective veg advocacy programs, and we'll help you really make an impact in your community, spreading messages of compassion for animals and spreading vegetarian and vegan eating. So again, if anyone's interested, all the information is online at www.compassionatecommunities.org. You can also sign up there to contact me. My email address is on the site, and let me know if you'd like to get involved.
Well, thank you so much, Nick, for coming on the Animal Voices show today to speak with us about your book, Change of Heart, What Psychology Can Teach Us About Spreading Social Change. It is available on Amazon, and I encourage our listeners to read this book if you want to learn more about the psychology of how humans think with regards to social change for the animals and much more. Thanks, Nick, and have a good day.
You too.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Next week on the show, to honor Remembrance Day, I'll be presenting a piece about animals in the time of war. We'll also have a feature interview with Daniel Imhoff, presented by Radio EcoShock's Alex Smith, and this interview will be on a subject matter that this author recently wrote about in two books, that is Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations, or CAFOs. We here at the Animal Voices show modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Please do check out our website as well, animalvoices.org, where our shows can also be always downloaded from. We are leaving you now with a song called Change Change by an artist called Thistle, based in the Lower Mainland here in BC. Stay tuned now for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Think you can get